2001. Lesson number 52, the end of the Republic. Okay. This is the end of the Republic, and Philip asked me which Republic, and it's the English Republic, and it's in its last days as we speak, historically speaking. But first, the public service announcement. We have pumpkin chocolate chip muffins up here. The blue and pink wrappers have walnuts. The yellow have no walnuts. If you're listening to the tape, well, sorry.
You said $9.99 too.
Yeah. Melodiesoven.com. This is going to be, as announced last week, a very short lesson. And we're going to save some time spend the rest of the time in discussion. We're doing that primarily so that we can start next week, when we're going to have a larger class at sort of a logical breaking point, which is the restoration itself. So we left off last time with the controversy between the resolutioners and protesters having been taken to London. In the event, Cromwell sent them home in the fall of 1657 without reaching a decision. And he referred the matter to the Scots Council of State. The resolutioners were represented by James Sharp, whom they trusted, unwisely as it turned out. Hewison says, in the spirit of Felix, Cromwell said he would hear them at a more convenient season and bade them go home and live in peace. That they would not do. 1658, Rutherford published his book, A Survey of the Survey of That Sum of Church Discipline, penned by Mr. Thomas Hooker. How's that for a title? Unfortunately, I was hoping to get this the book on CD, but it turns out not to be one of the ones that's on my CD full of Rutherford books. So, but Hewison says the preface accused the resolutioners of being worse persecutors than the bishops, of being soul murdering ministers who encouraged the vicious and ignorant. So that didn't go any long ways towards settling the debate there, but it did sort of I guess you could say libel or whatever the resolutioner is further abroad, because Rutherford was well respected abroad. Then on the 3rd of September 1658, Oliver Cromwell died, and I thought I'd read a summary from Hewison. Okay, again, James King Hewison, this is the history of the Covenanters. So oftentimes you'll hear the Covenanters referring very negatively to Cromwell. And even today, if you go to the Stillwater's Revival books site, I'm sure they refer to him as the usurper and other such, negative terms. And to be sure, there were a lot of negatives associated with him. In one of his biographers who's favorable to him pointed out that he tried five different forms of government, and his taxation was higher than Charles, and all these different things he'd done, and wasn't necessarily all good. But of course, he's living in very unsettled times, and sort of is a very unique position. But let's see, to read just one paragraph from Hewison, or maybe one and a half. On 3rd September 1658, his day of fate, Oliver Cromwell, weary of the interminable strife of political and religious parties, found rest and died expressing his confidence in these words: I am a conqueror and more than a conqueror through Christ that strengtheneth me. And praying earnestly for the people for whom he had fought, he was unquestionably the greatest Briton of his age. His Celtic blood determined his ideas in a religious mold. The secret of his power lay in his conviction that he was a humble instrument, predestined to act for his country's welfare under the guidance of the divine hand. It moved him to become the representative and defender of Protestantism in Europe in opposition to its Catholic rulers. In this action, he was ably supported by the poet Milton. He strove to confer unity and peace on the British Empire, and if he followed the patterns of the Old Testament rather than the more gentle teachings of the New, he always at least sought a warrant for his action in the soldier's pocket Bible, which every Ironside carried in his holster. And by the way, the full title of that is The Soldier's Pocket Bible Containing the Most, If Not All, Those Places Contained in the Holy Scripture, Which Do Show the Qualifications of His Inner Man, That Is a Fit Soldier to Fight the Lord's Battles, Both Before the Fight, In the Fight, and After the Fight, etc. So, yeah. Let's see, if Cromwell achieved nothing more than laying the foundations of that religious liberty which was reestablished at the Revolution in 1688, he deserves to be held in esteem by all lovers of true religious and political freedom such as Britain enjoys today. His character and place in British politics are well described by the late Principal Tulloch. Cromwell then was no hypocrite, no mere enthusiast. He was simply the greatest Englishman of his time, the most powerful, if not the most perfect expression of its religious spirit, and the master genius of its military and political necessities. Okay, well, and again, there's plenty to criticize Cromwell about, but I thought that, you know, coming from a Scottish historian, that was a, you know, interesting, you know, summation of his life. So, Cromwell at some point had been he'd either taken or received the perquisite of nominating his successor, and he nominated his son Richard Cromwell to succeed him. Richard became the Lord Protector. He inherited a somewhat intractable political situation. The Commonwealth had a debt of £2.5 million, when that was really some real money, and had an annual deficit of £300,000, which was mainly caused by spending on the army and navy. Okay, previously, I guess particularly coming out of a more feudal situation, there was no such thing as a standing army in England. And so the typical expenditure, you wouldn't have a lot of expenditure unless you were actually at war. Of course, you'll recall Charles I sometimes had money raising the expenditure, money that he needed. Okay, so Richard Cromwell was squeezed between the radicals in the army and a Republican minority that wanted to restore the Rump Parliament. In April 1659, he tried to use Parliament to get control over the army. Generals in the army went over to the radical faction, and Richard Cromwell was forced to dissolve the Parliament. The military started a new Parliament, then dissolved it, then called it up again on the 26th of December 1659. This left a somewhat confused and, I'll say, perhaps anarchical, but not one with a lot of rioting, but just unclear what the situation was. Situation in that one that General Monk in Scotland was unwilling to tolerate. Now, Monk ends up restoring Charles to the throne. He was somewhat secretive about what he was doing, and it was it's really probably unknown exactly when he decided that's what he was going to do. Some people think he started out just trying to take control of the situation, so on. But in any case, he ended up restoring Charles to the throne. General Monk gathered his officers in Greyfriars Church in Edinburgh and proclaimed his opposition to the English military party. Said he was in favor of making the military subservient to the civil government. They all joined them, and with 6,000 soldiers, they marched to London. Arrived in February of 1660 and restored the Rump Parliament, i.e., brought the Presbyterian-leaning members back on condition that they dissolve themselves quickly. They did dissolve themselves quickly, but before doing so, they approved the Westminster Confession of Faith, accepting chapters 30 and 31, that's of church censures and of synods and councils. And Robert Bailey actually wrote a letter to James Sharp where he complains about the fact that they approved it accepting those chapters, the fact that they accepted those chapters. They also ordered the Solemn League and Covenant to be reprinted, read annually in all churches, and hung up in Parliament House. And as Hewison says, this was the expiring effort at this crisis of ill-fated Presbyterian England. This was sort of the last gasp. They then dissolved themselves on March 16th. From there, events moved pretty quickly to a conclusion, as Monk at some point agreed to restore Charles II to the throne, and that happened on May 30th. The Resolutioners' representative, James Sharp, took a somewhat duplicitous role in the whole negotiations for restoration. It's been my plan to cover it next week, but part of the problem is it's hard to see how duplicitous he was until you see what actually happened. But was going to read a few quotes from Hewison again about Sharp. First of all, he points out that Sharp was welcomed by Monk, and Monk called him his good friend. Let's see. Monk soon gave the Scots ministers to understand that it shall be his care that the gospel ordinances and privileges of God's people may be established both here and there. This equivocal language gave rise to a vision of presbytery, restored, imperialized, glorified by their new Joshua, called of God in a strait. But when Monk, probably at the suggestion of Sharp, although Sharp disclaimed the idea, reinstated the secluded members of Parliament in order to outvote the rump, he plainly declared for a, quote, Presbyterian government, not rigid. A differentiation which somewhat blurred the vision of Douglas and the other restorers of Presbytery than allied to Monk. These enthusiasts failed to comprehend wherein the rigid nature of Presbyterianism should make it unpopular and undesirable, and wrote Sharp to this effect. Sharp and Monk understood each other. Reading between the lines, with the light thrown from subsequent events, one cannot fail to perceive that Sharp was early cognizant of the hatching of a policy which would take his co-presbyters by surprise. What other could it be than the entire discarding of the rigid religious system? However, it is difficult to determine the exact date on which Sharp abandoned the idea, if he ever cherished it, that a Cain pledge to the covenant was the only panacea for the national distemper. His constant asseverations that he was a genuine presbyter and that Lauderdale was no Episcopalian ill harmonized with the agility he soon afterwards displayed in leaping into prelatic place and power. In other words, after the Restoration, shortly thereafter, he became Archbishop of St. Andrews. In his long correspondence with Douglas, Sharp gave a partial and prejudiced account of current affairs in the capital, always contriving to leave out, as if unknown or unimportant, those facts which were indicators of the hidden movements of the Friends of Episcopacy and the exiled king. His written memoranda are equivocal and difficult to interpret. Sharp endeavored to work Douglas into a state of nervousness by informing him that the authorities reckoned the Resolutioners also to be Republican and disloyal, and that Douglas's republished sermon delivered at the Scone coronation was being received with this honor, with this favor. Sharp further mentioned Monk's distrust of the remonstrants, or the protesters, and his promise, if we be quiet, our business would be done to our mind, and what staggered Douglas and his friends, Monk's avowal that none but Sharp would gain his confidence. To further hoodwink these simple believers, Sharp narrated how a trusty party of Presbyterian clergy, with Lauderdale and himself, met and came to an agreement as to the restoration of the king on covenant lines. As a correspondent, Sharp seemed to be quite transparent and honest, as Mr. Andrew Lang would have us believe. But Sharp never told the half of what he knew, another half he couched in oracular terms. After mentioning how Monk would not let him depart, how the king knew every move in Scotland's affection, how the king was on the eve of returning to the joy of Presbyterians, and how the very Episcopalians were humbly seeking accommodation from the Presbyterians, Sharp thus sums up the matter on the 7th of April. The Lord having opened a fair door of hope, we may look for a settlement upon the grounds of the covenant, and thereby a foundation laid for security against the prolific and fanatic assaults, but I am dubious if this shall be the result of the agitations now on foot. The sly diplomatist did not inform his masters what he expected and what he expected and was working for. He adjured them to make no approach to the king till the king came, warned them against Middleton's design, and blamed Marie's mission against the king. To throw them off the true scent, he confessed, by the way, I smell that moderate episcopacy is the fairest accommodation which moderate men who wish well to religion expect. We the Scots shall be left to the king, which is best for us. The Resolutioners, realizing the peril, the more that they now knew how tired of rigid presbytery the youth of Scotland were, let Sharp understand that episcopacy was the prelude to prelatic tyranny, and that if the king would not accept their conditions, they undeterred would maintain their covenanted rights. Okay, the king also made a declaration on April 4th, and he by this time it was very clearly letters going back and forth between him and Monk, and he told Monk at one time he would be happy to let Monk choose sort of the time and the condition of the restoration as he saw fit. So he made this declaration at Breda, where he offered a general pardon to all except to those whom Parliament might accept. promised to allow Parliament to settle possible disputes over confiscated effects, and in a word, invited Parliament to specify the terms of his return to the throne. And when the English received this, the Parliament resolved on May 1st that according to the ancient and fundamental laws of the kingdom, the government is and ought to be by kings, lords, and commons. And that was sort of the end of the Republic. Let's see. Sharp is also was praised by some of the people who conspired to get the king back. Lauderdale said about Sharp, "God hath made him as happy an instrument in your service all along as any I know of his country." This is speaking to the king. "Nor need I say anything by so knowing a bearer who is employed by Monk, who under God hath done this work to give you a full account of those great transactions which laid the foundation of this happiness we are now, I hope, so near." In fine, Sharp was a secret envoy for Monk. And the Earl of Glencairn went even further and recommended Sharp as the only person capable to manage the design of setting up episcopacy in Scotland. So, and let's see. Charles wrote a letter from Scotland from Brussels on the 10th of April, professed his adherence to the Reformed faith. Let's see. Yeah, and Sharp, his account of, he had met with the king, I think, five times, but in his account he said, with verbosity and vagueness, that he found his majesty resolved to restore the kingdom to its former civil liberties and to preserve the settled government of our church. So, in any case, Sharp, as we'll see later, you know, ends up persecuting the Covenanters. So does Lauderdale, who was earlier a Covenanter, and he had a role to play in these negotiations that was somewhat duplicitous. You could also read some of his letters back and forth to Robert Bailey, where Robert Bailey at first is trying to, is writing him about the protest or resolution or controversy. Later, Bailey, who's rather gullible, you know, is writing to Sharp saying he doesn't believe all these things that he's hearing about Sharp. And later he writes him to ask for his help in the civil magistrates being merciful on some of the people like Samuel Rutherford. So, okay. Anyways, that's about where I'd like to stop today. I have three questions for discussion, which I guess I'll read, and then I'm going to shut the tape off so we can freely discuss. Plus, I could eat pumpkin chocolate chip muffins then. Okay. So here's my questions to get things started. We can go from here. Assuming that the protesters were right, and I think history proved them correct, what could they have done when they would have been outvoted at any level of the Presbyterian hierarchy? Okay, that was their situation in, say, 1651, 1652, right, where they, I think theologically they were right, they had the right analysis of their current situation, but in a Presbyterian system, clearly they could have been outvoted. Okay, second question. Granting that the resolutioners thought they were correct in resolving to support the king, was there any justification for cutting off debate in the way that they did? Right? They basically, in effect, disciplined the ministers who preached against the resolutions. And if you say no, then the question is, could a situation arise where it would be necessary to cut off debate and, in effect, cut off a significant number of the ministers and elders? And by this, I mean either disciplining or them just, you know, telling them they've got to be silent. Right. In this particular case, counting ministers only, there were about 900 ministers in Scotland. It was reckoned that about 150 were protesters. So it's probably a few. There were a few presbyteries and so on where the protesters, or at least one where the protesters were a majority, but most of them was the other way around. Okay, third question. Both the protester and resolutioner side tried to get the civil magistrate to either favor their own side or take action against the other side. Is this an inherent problem with an established church? If so, would it invalidate the concept of an established church? Or maybe we should say, after all, there are inherent problems in every form of church-state relations. So Those are my three questions, and we will stop the tape there and leave it for the class to discuss or the listener to think about.